You let one ant stand up to us, then they all might stand up. Those puny little ants outnumber us 100 to 1. And if they ever figure that out, there goes our way of life. It's not about food. It's about keeping those ants in line. That's why we're going back.
Does anybody else want to stay?
Let's ride!
Shake your head, hit that jive jack, put it in your pocket till I get back. Time and time waits for
Well, what are we gonna do? Time and time waits for no man, and ain't got time to shake your hand, baby. Welcome to the show. It's the Wednesday night edition at 7.02 p.m. on the East Coast, and Professor Lawson Bowling is going to be with us shortly, but he's currently finishing a meal. I was waiting by the front door. I shit you not, waiting by the front door, you know, like 6:55. I'm like, all right, getting a little bit close here. And we know the time, so this is going to be like the fourth time he's been on the show. And he said, be there soon. I said, okay, you remember how to get to the suite, right? Okay, and I gave him a number to call in case I had to launch the show. He said, I'm eating nearby. And that was at 6:58 p.m., 2 minutes before the show goes live. So I write back to him. I said, like in the middle of a meal? He goes, almost done. All right. What can I say? So he's going to be here. This is not a cancellation. Do not worry. So that's going to happen. But now the question is, what are we going to talk about tonight? Well, I have a lot of things to talk about. And some of these questions are sourced from you guys. And of course, you guys have all... Thank you so much. I see Nikki says, great shirt, Frank. Thank you so much. White Star Line, Titanic crew. I got this shirt actually in 1995. You want to say, what are you talking about, 1995? You were in fifth grade, Frank. Exactly. Shirt grew with me. I swear to God. I think we're talking about quantum mechanics with this thing. Because usually a shirt will start wearing thin. It'll be holes in it. You'll start busting through it as you mature. This thing has grown with me. It is so weird and so eerie how this shirt has grown with me. And it's actually like it's grown in proportion with me. It hasn't gotten tighter or nothing. So, I don't know. But what are we going to talk about? Well, it's always history night when Professor Bowling is with us. So we're going to be talking about a few things. First of all, I want to see how he enjoyed his election. Because it's been a long time. It's been since the summer since he was on. So the election is come and gone. I want to talk about the history of contested elections. I want to talk about faithless electors and all that stuff. We have a great question from Gadget Doc. Do you see a parallel between our current nuclear umbrella and our interlocking alliances of World War I? That's good. That's going to be a cool one. And then, of course, my own personal concerns about trade as it pertains to the relationship, the possible relationship, and similarities between Herbert Hoover and Donald Trump. And as we know, they are both very big on trade and tariffs. And so we'll do all that. It's going to be fun. It's going to be a fun night. But other than that, since we have a little bit of time until we get started, there's something I wanted to put out there. Look at this. Okay, so my mother went to... Oh, I got to log in. My mother went into the city yesterday because she really loves Patti LuPone, the Broadway star and vocalist. And she was doing some sort of an interview. I forgot for which show or what production, anything like that, but... My mother has been to dozens and dozens and dozens of Patti LuPone anything. Whether it be, you know, a solo performance, she is starring in a production of something, whether it be, you know, Gypsy or anything else like that. We got to see her a few times there. It could be this interview type stuff. It could be anything. She DVRs everything that Patti LuPone's in on television. Doesn't matter what the hell it is. Okay, so she has to know who my mother is by now. Has to. She's gotten 10,000 autographs, taken 15,000 pictures. She's like a 16-year-old girl, my mother, when it comes to Patti LuPone and Broadway stars. My mother and father are alike in this way. Okay? They still go to Broadway productions together, and they're like best of friends in that sense. It's ridiculous. But the thing is that my mother, she gets mad at me. Because whenever we get together, and whenever we're watching TV or something, and she has seen something that we've already seen. For example, Homeland. She got us into Homeland. So whenever my mother has seen something that you're watching right now, she's the type who, in all of her excitement, I know what's coming next. And like, get out, just leave. Mom, out of the room. Just get out. I don't want to see you tense up. I don't want to see you giggle. I don't want anything that is going to tell me what the hell's coming up next, okay? So, we've got this going on over here. Oh, wait. I think Professor Bowling's here. Hold on, you know what? I'm going to go on a break. We'll do this later on. This is still funny. Look at this Christmas tree for a second. BRB. So I am back, and we're both back. Professor, can you speak into the microphone for a little check?
Here I am, Frank.
Oh, loud and proud. This is fantastic. And joining us once again, for the first time in a long time, the last time was over the summer, right?
That's right.
So we actually, you know what? You see that that webcam right in front of you? Can you tilt it down? Just you know, tilt it down.
You mean the thing on top with the blue?
That's it. Let's see.
Tilt it down.
Just a little bit of a tilt. There you go. Perfect. There you go. You're fully in frame.
Oh, okay.
See, here we are. We're just chilling out. Now, Professor, last time we were on, we were talking about a number of things. We went all over the world. It was, you know, World War II usually comes up at one point or another.
Well, especially with the 75th anniversary just the other day.
Yes, I wanted to talk about that as well. What's the significance of the Japanese Prime Minister that came and visited Pearl Harbor for the first time?
Well, of course, the people responsible for that attack are long gone.
Exactly.
And to put it in a little historical context, not too many years after World War II ended, all right, the attack is 1941, World War II ends in 1945, and then in 1949, the communists take over China. So the United States, shortly after that, in the early 1950s, kind of pivoted toward Japan, and ever since, the U.S. has tried pretty hard to get along with Japan. Now, of course, the Cold War ended 25 years ago, so that's ancient history. But China's still communist, at least politically speaking. So better relations with Japan is still something that people want. And, of course, one of the ironies is President Obama is a native of Hawaii. So the whole story of the attack would have been something that he literally grew up with.
Well, you know, I'm sure we're going to circle back around to this at some point. But more immediately speaking, how was your election? And are you happy it's over? What did you take away from this? Because there's a few things we got to cover. The next thing that's coming up is unavoidable, what I have to ask.
Well, I have been teaching American history and political history for a long time as a part of it. And I got to say that the election of 2016 is as big a surprise as I'm familiar with. And I did say to somebody a couple of months before the election, because, of course, I read what everybody else reads, therefore I was surprised, but I did say that if Donald Trump managed to be elected, he must have had some kind of feel for something going on out there that just about everybody else missed. which, of course, is very interesting, and now I've been trying to sort of figure out what that is. But, yes, 2016 is a reminder that, you know, the votes do count, at least the electoral votes.
You know what? You closing with that is the perfect statement, because just a couple of nights ago, we said, listen, regardless of anything, 2016 made me at least a believer. You know how we always talk about cryptids and creatures that are rumored to exist, but you never really see it. Everybody always has their theories about how much the votes count or don't count at all and whatever. Well, if 2016 was anything, it can't be definitive one way or another, but if it was anything, it was the point that Loch Ness Monster just kind of peaked above the water just a second and went right back down. Because what else can you say? What else can you say? The votes were cast, despite whatever everybody in their Russian hack stuff. The votes were cast. Russians didn't go and cast votes in place of Americans.
Well, it remains to be seen what might be uncovered about what that's all about. But I would doubt myself a whole lot of people voted differently from how they might have voted if none of that had ever occurred, whatever it actually was anyway. But going back to sort of the question of being in a free country and the election cycle has a kind of openness to it, two of the phenomena of 2016 were Senator Sanders of Vermont and then President-elect now Trump. And they're both not people that the mainstream people who control the two major political parties really wanted in there. Now, the people who control the Democratic Party were able, with a little hard work behind the scenes, to kind of try to get the nominee they really wanted, Clinton.
Yeah, kind of.
But on the other side, the Republican Party's leadership and establishment, they really did not want Trump.
They were trying to repel him the whole time.
But they could not prevent his nomination, and then once he was nominated, the party establishment accepted that with some reluctance, because of course there's a bottom line in politics, as there is in a lot of things. You want to win, and if you don't win, then you're kind of reduced to talking maybe to yourself for a while. So the party leadership did sort of accept Trump once he managed to get the nomination, but I think a lot of them were surprised. From what I read, the Trump people, the morning of Election Day, thought they had a chance. They were not, you know, they did not believe that they were in a hopeless situation, but I think they were sort of, you know, pleasantly surprised that things broke the way that their sort of whole strategy was, to try to see if they could make them break that way. Well, they did.
Well, let me ask you this. Now, I wanted to get into this part now, because you're talking about the whole point is to win. Well, there was a victor on election night, probably around 3 o'clock in the morning. That's when the speech happened. That's when another speech didn't happen. And from there on, it has been, we're in like the third phase of people trying to reverse it. First, we had the recount stuff. Now we're having the faithless elector and the contested elections. Now, we have a history. There is history of contested elections in this country, and I know you'll know a lot about that. And I wanted to bring up the whole idea of faithless electors. And the first thing I wanted to ask about the electors themselves, and then I have other questions.
Sure.
The first question is this. Why is it that if a state has a winner-take-all type of setup with their popular vote, where in Arizona, the popular vote, X amount of electoral votes goes toward X amount of candidate, whoever won the popular vote. Why is it that once those electoral votes are won, you need actual, physical, living, breathing people to file each vote, and not only that, have some kind of conscious ability to influence whether or not they file them?
Well, Frank, I know you like the Constitution. You're a student of it. So as the Constitution lays it out, the electors are people. They are running for the office of presidential elector. And when the founders invented the system whereby the president was to be chosen, I don't think they remotely conceptualized what it has evolved into. I don't know what they would have thought about it, but it's not what they expected. They expected that people would actually run for the office of being presidential elector, and that people would sort of select the best person to bear that responsibility. I hasten to add, because I've kind of misstated it really, the states have an absolute right to choose their presidential electors by any method they choose. And not all states got into the business of electing by popular vote presidential electors right away. Now, the very last state that has ever gotten their electors any other way was Colorado in 1876. The legislature appointed their presidential electors. But that was done by some other states prior to the Civil War. But of course, as America evolved into a more democratic election, for example, everybody takes it for granted now that adult citizens should have the right to vote, at least if they're not convicted felons. And even some of them are given the right to vote when they've served their time. So anyway, that's a given, and nobody imagines anything else. The whole system of having presidential electors chosen by the voters, you know, became quite normal, you know, well before the Civil War, and then completely the way it is done. But the electors are people, and, you know, for people who have nothing to do in a few days, C-SPAN actually broadcasts quite a few of the meetings of the presidential electors. So if anybody's curious to see what happens when the electors meet, you can watch it. And it's a reminder of federalism, because the states do it differently. Some states, the electors meet very, very briefly. Others, it's a more elaborate ceremony. It's up to each state. But the electors for a given state meet in that particular state capital. They do actually cast votes, and then those votes are counted, and the results are reported to Congress in a kind of a bureaucratic form, which is called, I believe, a certificate of ascertainment.
And now there's four, we have four elections where one candidate had more popular votes but did not win the Electoral College. And that was in 1824. Of course, 1876, which you just mentioned, you mentioned it with Colorado, but I wanted to bring up 1876. Mm-hmm. And not only 1876, but the Compromise of 77. This was brought up by actually a friend of ours, a colleague, and one of the producers of a show, right. Red Blooded America blog. He actually wanted to bring this up because there was that. This is between 1876.
Tilden and Hayes.
Yeah, Tilden and Hayes. And there was a 20 electoral vote swing along, what was it, Florida, Louisiana, and
South Carolina, I believe.
Okay. And can you color all that in, because that actually, to some people say, most people say, that officially marked the end of Reconstruction as well.
Well, that's true, and the long-range impact of that is some of the things that are still done to try to come up with a definitive solution to the presidential election, should it be in dispute, are actually laws that came out of that disputed election. And some of those things kicked in. We'd all kind of forgotten about them in the semi-disputed election of 2000 in the state of Florida. So the closeness of the vote always makes people look at the things in detail. And part of the controversies of 1876, as you mentioned, the word Reconstruction, and a big heart of the Reconstruction controversy was who can vote. Are the former enslaved people, as well as the free persons of color in the former Confederate states, to be allowed to vote or not? They were being allowed to vote. The 15th Amendment made that on paper definitive, but there was still a political struggle. And one of the reasons that the supporters of Hayes were willing to kind of go all out to come up with those 20 votes and put them in his column that were disputed is because they did believe, with reason, that significant numbers of their voters had been victims of voter suppression, including violence or intimated violence in 1876. Of course, the trouble with things like that is, whatever the reason, if you didn't actually cast a vote, it's not there. But as we certainly were reminded back in 2000 when the election went to overtime in Florida, you can examine the small number of ballots, and if it's truly a micro close election, a few ballots can be ruled to be this or ruled to be that by some authority, and then you can swing it. So that was the outcome. But because this was so close and so controversial, and of course there's more to the story than I've summarized so far, the outcome was a behind-the-scenes, unrecorded compromise that meant that as soon as Hayes was put into office in 1877, he removed the last of the U.S. Army troops from the three southern states that still had them, sort of sending a signal quite physically that the U.S. government was going to leave the South alone, and whatever the South did, more or less, was going to be whatever they did. And the long-range outcome of that was institutionalized white supremacy.
So, do you think? Would you say that the compromise of 1877 really put off the civil rights movement as we know for another 100 years?
Well, it's not for nothing that the post-World War II modern-day civil rights movement that at this point you guys learn about in school, and which I remember just the tail end of as a child myself, was called the Second Reconstruction. The whole idea being that the Reconstruction after the Civil War had been interrupted and not completed, and therefore you needed to sort of pick up where it had been left off. I mentioned, for example, this was the clearest thing, that the 15th Amendment, which is the third of the post-war Civil War Reconstruction Amendments, flatly says that you cannot deny the right to vote on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. And just as importantly, it has a second clause that says, Congress shall have the power to enforce this article by appropriate legislation. So in that case, with the plain English I just recited, there was no question that Congress had the power to do something about it. You know, sometimes people say this is a good thing, but the question becomes, but is the authority actually there to do it, or does that authority belong to somebody else? But in this case, there was no question about it. But there you have it. The Constitution is words on a page, and unless people breathe life into them, they're going to be words on a page. But when life was breathed into them, then it came to be the case that by, I would say, about 1970, you could say with a straight face that if you want to vote, more or less you can vote, and if you're some odd exception to that and you believe your vote's being suppressed, you have actual recourse.
Mm. Very, very, very interesting. Because today was that was the first time, you know, reading into this and seeing, and you're, that interruption you were talking about in the Reconstruction, that interruption being the Compromise of 77 for the most part?
Yeah, the sort of thing that got the element of the Democratic Party to accept the Republican presidential victory, narrow as it was, by the margin of one electoral vote, the closest in history, was this promise. Again, this was never written on paper, but it was done in fact, that the North would give up on Reconstruction and let the South kind of do whatever it cared to do. Now, that resulted in laws that were designed to suppress the votes of black people, no question about it, and then also the creation of a regime of segregation by law, which the Supreme Court gave the green light to in the 1890s by a vote of 8-1, with that famous phrase, separate but equal. In other words, the separate things on paper were supposed to be equal. If they were not, then that was legally actionable and you could, you know, file a suit against it, but otherwise segregation was okay. You didn't have to do it, but you could do it, and therefore by the post-World War II civil rights movement, when the Brown decision overturned that earlier separate but equal line, I believe 17 of the 48 states had some legal school segregation. That means the other 31 did not have legal school segregation. They may have had school segregation in fact, but not by established law.
Mm. Now, moving away from this for a little bit, because, of course, we can always come back to it. We know there was something just came out today. So I think it was from redstate.com or something that said about 20 electoral college voters may flip their vote. Now, of course, 37 is the difference between the two. So this I think it's just everything is one big protest motion after another, right up until January 19th or whatever the hell it is. So, I mean, there's just that going on. And
well, it would be very, very shocking and unprecedented if 20 faithless electors turned up. That's hard. That's very hard to believe. In the past, of course, there have been a handful of faithless electors. And if I recall correctly, not too many years ago, there was an incompetent elector who filled out his or her ballot incorrectly. But there wasn't anything that could be done about it. And since apparently it didn't seem to matter anyway, I believe it was just recorded how it had been incorrectly and incompetently done.
Well, it says there's been four instances of faithless electors in history. Mike Padden, elector of Washington State, cast his vote in 1976 for Reagan instead of Ford. In 2000, there was a 266 to 271. One elector, Barbara Lett Simmons, abstained in protest for lack of District of Columbia representation. 2004, a Minnesota elector wrote in John Edwards, the Democratic vice presidential candidate, by mistake. You're talking, there you go. And then 2000, and it says 2016, blank. We don't know yet. So.
Well, I believe at least one person has gotten 15 minutes of fame by saying for a while now that he's going to do it. But as far as I know, even in the states that on paper have a law requiring the electors to be faithful, I don't know that any, I don't think there's anything anybody can do about it if they're not.
Right. Well, okay, so, you know, moving on to something else now.
Sure.
We have one of these questions. One of the questions that came from the audience, another one came from Gadget Doc in the chat room. Mm-hmm. And Gadget Doc asked, do you see a parallel? This is a World War I question tied into modern day. Do you see a parallel between our current nuclear umbrella and our interlocking alliances of World War I?
Well, in terms of the interlocking alliances of World War I, well, we didn't have any. Now, the European countries definitely had them. And that did play a great role in what was a relatively minor tragedy crime devolving into a tremendous catastrophe. But the U.S. didn't have those kinds of alliances in those days. Now, another difference is we're on the other side, not only of World War I, but also of World War II. The people who started World War I, from everything I've ever read about it, appear to have been quite naive, really, about what total war in the modern age of machine guns, et cetera, might really imply. And we no longer have that naivete. Of course, there's been a lot of effort to make smarter bombs, et cetera, and they are smarter. Okay, so that's sort of that. Now, the nuclear umbrella, since two atomic bombs were used in 1945, there is an awareness of the destructive power, although everybody says that the hydrogen bombs are much, much worse. However, in terms of strategic nuclear bombs, that's one thing. There is such a thing as tactical nuclear weapons, which are not going to blow up the whole world, quote unquote. But there's such a taboo about those things that, there is a great, great, great reluctance to imagine using them. Now, whether or not a rogue terrorist organization would have that reluctance, I doubt it. People are very, very, edgy about avoiding nuclear weapons. Of course, other weapons of destruction, mass destruction and otherwise, are quite destructive.
Mm. Well, hey, and by the way, everybody, you can call in right now at any point during the next half hour. The Skype is Quite Frankly Podcast. That's the Skype, Quite Frankly Podcast. You can call in. You can drop whatever you'd like into our laps over here. Bring up whatever you want. We have Professor Bowling at least until 8 o'clock. I think we might dribble over a little bit, but not too much tonight because I got to go slip into a band practice.
Okay.
But in either case, one thing I wanted to also bring up was, and then we can just ad lib a little bit from there because this is all I have, is when looking at a presidency like Herbert Hoover, Mm-hmm. Okay. And moving into right on that, right when we're starting to see the Great Depression open its gaping mouth and swallow everything up. One of the things there that I thought was a little bit disconcerting to see, to, at least for me, to draw a vague parallel or a vague similarity between Donald Trump and Herbert Hoover, is that they like to talk a lot about trade, tariffs, and all this stuff. And, of course, when you look at a lot of people point to Smoot-Hawley, a tariff that, you know, is that a tax on 20,000 or more imported goods that subsequently started a trade war. And most people say that it contributed to the Great Depression worsening. Other people say it really didn't have that much of an impact. But still, is this something that you think could be really dangerous, especially given our economic instability, the debt that we have looming over our head? Have you seen anything in Trump's trade ideas that can prove to be dicey?
Well, trade war, of course, is a loaded term. And if anybody, us, China, or anybody else, were to quote-unquote declare a trade war, that's a war. And wars leave behind a lot of collateral damage. So I doubt that anybody would want to go that far. What are people's backgrounds anyway? Herbert Hoover did work in the business world, but he was an engineer. Donald Trump is a businessman. He's done various things, a lot of them sort of real estate type deals. He did major in economics, I've read, and did that down in Philadelphia at the U of PA, my own alma mater, actually. I think somebody who's been experienced in business for a long, long time, just like being experienced in running online radio or anything else, you do develop a certain capacity to understand things. The thing that Trump seemed to have noticed that other people noticed far less was these parts of America that cannot buy the notion that free trade has helped them. Now, free trade, do we really have it? As a candidate, Mr. Trump talked about bad trade deals. The promise is better trade deals. Now, he certainly has a lot of business experience, so perhaps that, you know, can have more substance than some of the things that office seekers say. Of course, he's not a normal office seeker. He's never been a professional politician. This is not anything he ever tried to do before, and he, quote, didn't have to. He could have just retired at this point, but I guess he's got more energy than he would know what to do with. If you go too far away from accepting the logic of market relations, there is a price to be paid. Inefficiency means higher prices, which means people can't handle it. But, free trade per se is, like many things, an abstract ideal. To move toward it in general, I think most people would say, if you took micro and macro, and I did, that this is kind of economic rationality. But everything isn't rational. Last thing I'll just mention, and I admit I don't have any great, great grasp of this, is what people call currency manipulation. China is a funny country because while it has adopted quite a bit more in recent decades market economics, they haven't quite gone all the way with that, and the state has a whole lot of influence in those things, much, much greater than what we're used to around here.
Very, very interesting. Very interesting. So then maybe there's not a lot, there's no real thing to be that worried about. But, of course, we have to just sit back and strap in for this ride. When the ride begins, I don't know, because I'll tell you, this has been the longest month since. I thought that, okay, you know what, the election comes and goes, then we have, you know, we have Thanksgiving, we have Christmas, we get to relax a little bit. This has been the longest month and change ever.
I think a lot of that comes out of the surprise, because right. I don't think it's hyping it to say this is as big a surprise as we've seen in a national election, and people, therefore, were not prepared for it. Like I said, my understanding is that the winners, and I'm just talking about the presidential election, not the other elections, were, you know, believe they had a decent shot. But, you know, I think it's not something that was by any means considered a lock or even highly probable. So that, of course, makes it more interesting and more uncertain. And that is to take the other side, I think they, you know, based on everything that everybody wrote and said in their own internal polls, really, really did not expect this at all. And therefore, it's not been that easy to deal with.
Well, that's a good place to stop the first half of the show. I'm going to start. I want to give my my thank yous right now for everybody on who supports the show on Patreon. We're sitting here with Professor Lawson Bowling. This is what is this? Your fourth time hanging out with us?
That sounds about right, Frank.
About that. Well, we're hanging out here. I want to thank everybody for supporting the show. Then, of course, the Skype is on. I want to get you guys calling in to talk with us, to bring up your own ideas, your own questions, whatever it is. So take a couple of seconds to think about it. But for everybody that supports me on patreon.com/quitefrankly, I want to thank you because you are my bosses. So here are the names of my bosses that I read out every night. And aside from that, we write letters, pen pals. We communicate with each other as Jefferson and Adams did, okay? Right until the end when they put their differences aside, they're like, you know, he's not that bad of a guy. And we write to each other every month. So we have a whole bunch of good stuff out there on Patreon for you to free market solutions to support the show. You always get something back. Trust me. So I want to thank Michael Wells, Matt Smith, Rudy Escarcega, Matt DeFabio of the 1984 Club, Brad Meyer, his co-founder, Nikki Solis, who upped it to 1999. Damn. Sean Collins, Jackie Milam, Andrew Great Dame, Christian Peppas of the Amatory Murder. Thank you, my man. Jenny Lee, Kate McCallum, Brian O'Connor Jr., Marianne Hart, Eric Reitz, Max Ancaparato, Laura Veris, Perry and Stacy Little, Rob Corrado, Whitney McShann, Brent Antilles from the UK, Pierre from France, my man, thank you so much. LS Dan, what's going on, Spratlin? I see you. And Mike May, thank you so much for your support. And of course, Stephanie K from StephanieKBeauty.com. Go to her when you want to have your face done up with all nice makeup, and she'll turn you into a ghoul, a goblin, or she'll turn you into a blushing bride, whatever you want. She's fantastic. Calling in right now is our good friend, Gadget Doc. He hung up. Let's try him again. Brian, you're on right now with Professor Lawson Bowling and myself. What's going on, man?
Hey, how you doing? Very quickly, I wanted to kind of open up that question. It wasn't necessarily our alliances during World War One, because he's correct, we didn't have alliances. I was trying to get him to have a comparison as towards our NATO / East Asia alliances, and trying to draw a parallel between how we have those alliances due to the Cold War and built upon versus the European alliances and the going on with that. And second part of that, to kind of open that up and to kind of circle it back around, is, you know, the influence of China in the modern era from the time of the Chinese Civil War, from Chiang Kai-shek and Mao Zedong's Civil War, and the evacuation, shall we say, of Chiang Kai-shek to Taiwan, and the relations that has historically and potentially ongoing, because that's another thing that's going on, is, of course, one China policy. And as far as currency manipulation, just wanted to add real quick, the big thing about China's currency manipulation, if I can speak tonight, is that it's not a pegged currency, and therefore they can kind of float it, and it doesn't really matter. They can print whatever they want. Okay. I'm gonna get off here.
Wait. I remember the NATO and the remember the NATO and the European alliances World War One question. I'll save that one second. How about we do your China question first? Can you repeat that one more time, at least just for me?
Okay, so for China, right? We're talking about the Chinese Civil War. Mm-hmm. Okay, this is right after the Second World War. We have Mao Zedong and Chiang Kai-shek. Chiang Kai-shek got his ass beat, okay?
Mm.
He had to get evacuated by the U.S. government to Taipei, which we call Taiwan, all right? And because of Cold War politics, we have a defense law for them. However, with Nixon's trip to China and then subsequent presidential stuff going on, we had the one China policy, so we have a conflict there. So I wanted to see how that kind of would fit into that situation too. How our East Asia policy is going to be tied both with trade and historically, and you know, kind of look in your crystal ball and take a look. All right, I'm gonna get off of here and just listen to the answer.
Okay, so one child policy, one China policy,
one China,
one China, and the Taipei conflict there. Anything?
Well, it is funny, and I read this recently. Everybody's been saying for the longest time that there is only one China. Funny how the thing that everybody says and everybody agrees with is not really true. Since 1950, there have been two Chinas, whatever everybody says. Taiwan is not governed by Beijing, and it hasn't been since 1950. So everybody says there's one China, except there isn't. I wonder if that ever makes anybody think besides me. Mm. Now, China had a slow getting out of the gate in their efforts to become what I guess everybody thinks they should become again, one of the world's great, great countries. When Mao took over, he famously said, China has stood up. And then the Beijing Olympics, let's say, was supposed to sort of be the exclamation point on that process, which really started getting some momentum when Deng Xiaoping took China onto the path of much more respect for market economics than they had had under Mao. And if Mao had much interest in economics, it's escaped me. But Deng Xiaoping and the rest kind of picked up on a widespread and very widely disseminated in Asia and other places Chinese entrepreneurial tradition. Okay, so that's become modern China. Now, communism sort of went out of business in Europe 25 years ago. That, I'll briefly say, is sort of brought into question, what exactly is NATO for? Because we know why NATO was started, the concern about communism, but Cold War ended 25 years ago, so what's NATO for? Now, with regard to Taiwan, when the U.S. did recognize the communist dictatorship in Beijing, you know, recognition is just, we recognize it. They are, in fact, the government of mainland China. That's a fact. The best thing that ever happened to Taiwan after that great disappointment, bizarrely, was Tiananmen Square. Because suddenly people in the United States, when the communist Chinese demonstrated that they're still a dictatorship and still a police state and, you know, nipped in the bud the China democracy movement on the mainland, Americans suddenly were a little more sympathetic to Taiwan. Therefore, the sort of sale of armaments, et cetera, to it. Now, the United States has a lot of trade with Taiwan, but China, of course, is many, many times bigger, and there's no reason for the U.S. to not want to get along with China. Trade, sure. The impact of China in the Pacific world does seem to be, in recent years especially, that China's trying to become the regional power of their part of the world, and they might say, just as the United States declared itself almost 200 years ago, the dominant force in the Western Hemisphere, which doesn't mean everybody else is enslaved, we hope, but it's kind of a recognition of a certain reality.
Hmm.
The current problems of the U.S. with the Philippines, and the Philippines' relatively new government being more oriented toward China, you know, indicate that China can get a response. Now, Japan, China, you haven't fully gotten over World War II. Okay, the U.S. and Japan have gotten over it because there's the prime minister in Pearl Harbor the other day for the 75th anniversary. But China, Japan is not quite so smooth even now. So just taking that as a symbol, I think Japan remains a little more tilted toward the U.S.
So now shifting gears to that really, just really quickly, maybe if there's a way you can nutshell it, because I'd like to call up Max from Colorado, who had a question or a quip about the electors again. But Gadget Doc, the first thing he had asked was to clarify the whole intermingling alliances in Europe leading up to World War One, not necessarily with America. So the intermingling alliances, as opposed to NATO, like as far as that goes?
Well, World War One kind of came about because of Germany really, really making quite an impact in growth once it became a unified country in 1870-71. And then Germany was looking for a place in the sun and being a bigger force in Europe, and did that imply militarism? Remember that the early 1900s is still the age of imperialism. Well, this kind of gets other people worrying. France had lost to Prussia in the 1870-71 war that produced the unification of Germany. So France became interested in a rapprochement with its traditional enemy, England, of all people. Now, of course, Austria was still the seat of a multi-ethnic, multinational empire, but the people who ran it were German language people and therefore felt that affinity with Germany. So that's sort of why that was a natural alliance. Mm-hmm. And then Russia and France having an alliance, kind of both worrying about Germany and what it might do. Now, that kind of gives you very briefly the broad contours of the setup. The triggering of mobilization and then actual war is kind of what sets into motion sort of a booby trap. And then the last little thing to remember is that when Germany decided to attack France by invading Belgium, that brings the British Empire into the war, because Britain had a guarantee treaty with friendly, small Belgium right across the English Channel. And the German attack on Belgium was seen as indefensible, since Belgium was a small, peaceful, neutral country. And I always think it's better to say the British Empire, not Britain and not England, because at this point, the British Empire is 25% of the whole world. Hmm. So when World War One gets going, it's not just England, it's Canada, Australia, South Africa, India, which in those days meant India, Pakistan, Bangladesh. So that's quite an array of forces.
Absolutely. So, and then, but of course, in relation to NATO now.
Yeah, now NATO, I'm always intrigued by the sort of hangover effect. I never cease to be amazed that people keep talking about the United States and its allies. That term really is a World War II term. The U.S. didn't want to be fully into World War One and called itself an associated power, not an ally. But in World War II, of course, we had the Allies. The odd man out in the alliance was the Soviet Union, but the Soviet Union went out of business on December the 31st, 1991. But people still talk about the Allies and the U.S.'s allies. Well, I sometimes ask the question, allies against whom? Allies against what? Because this is a hangover term from a long, long time ago. And since NATO was formed because of the concern about the possible literal invasion of Western and parts of Southern Europe by the Soviet Union, and since the Soviet Union ceased to exist 25 years ago, what exactly is NATO for? And I think that has been a question. But, of course, these days, and maybe this stuff about interference from the election has put the spotlight on it again, you know, worrying about Russia is becoming, you know, more of a concern. And really, if one reads in any detail the sad stuff that's been coming out of Syria for a long time now, yeah, you can definitely be concerned about actions of the Russian government.
So worrying about Russia is like a planetary pastime at this point.
Well, apparently so. But of course, people can make kind of glib comparisons that aren't really solid and substantial. I don't think Russia is trying to take over the world anymore, driven by a messianic ideology. Rather, they become, like a lot of other countries, they're asserting their own self-interest. And since Russia has a sense of itself as a large country and a country that maybe should be greater than they actually are at the moment, maybe that puts more of a chip on their shoulder. Exactly what that means. I mean, the thing that they've gotten the most attention for of this nature in recent months was the Crimean Peninsula, which they did just take over. And that was, kind of an illegal thing, unquestionably, I would say. But it is a little bit more complicated because there are a lot of Russian people in the Crimean Peninsula, and historically that had not really been part of Ukraine, etc. It was given to Ukraine by a Soviet dictator in the 1950s as a gift, however bizarre that sounds now. Hmm. Nevertheless, I repeat, there's no question that that Russia taking over Crimea recently was illegal, and it's very easy to make the case that that was not justifiable.
Well, moving on to something else now, because the time is ticking away, and it always evaporates when we're hanging out. But I want to call up Max from Colorado now, who's got some thoughts he'd like to drop onto the table as well. And let's see what's going on here. Max, what's going on, my friend? You're on.
Patty.
Hey.
Good to have you.
So I wanted to bring up the electors that the professor, he said at one point, I think, that he wasn't sure what they're going to do about the faithless electors in the states that have laws requiring them to do so. This is from Fox 31 Denver, KDVR. A judge state court ruled Tuesday, is that today? Yeah. That all Colorado electors to the Electoral College must vote for Hillary Clinton or vacate their positions. Elizabeth Starrs said if electors take the oath and don't vote for Clinton, they would face criminal penalties.
What are those penalties, though? I've seen that some of the penalties are as little as, a couple of days in jail and $1,000.
Colorado electors could face up to 1 year in jail and $1,000 fine if they defy the law and vote for someone other than Clinton.
Oh, a year.
Okay, but I would say that, let's say they actually were sentenced to those things. They still would have voted for somebody else, and I don't think those penalties can change their faithlessness, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
It'll be too late. It's like I already ran through the red light. Okay, now I'll get punished, but I already ran through it.
Absolutely.
Well, I think that if they said that they would replace the electors, literally, like they would remove them. They have other ones in standby to do.
Well, yeah. Suppose one of the electors dropped dead, God forbid, tomorrow morning. I would assume that somebody on the state committee of the party that had won the presidential vote would choose a replacement. It's very apt that they're called faithless electors. I mean, I don't know if people ever ask themselves the question, how do you become a presidential elector? I'll give you an example of a presidential elector from New York State who was elected a few weeks ago. He lives in Chappaqua here in Westchester County, Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton is an elected presidential elector from New York State.
So he's going to be...
He will be traveling to Albany in a few days, and he will attend the meeting, which will probably be on C-SPAN somewhere, and will vote for Hillary Clinton for president.
Just as Nancy Pelosi's daughter is out there in California.
Yeah. The kind of people who get chosen to be presidential electors, to have the honor of running for that office, and people are elected presidential electors, are usually... party stalwarts. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a pretty low level of pseudo-corruption, but I imagine if you donated $5 million to the Colorado Republican Party, they'd make you an elector next time. It's a kind of an honor, something to tell your grandchildren.
So the thing is here is that the Secretary of State has said that they will disqualify their vote This is quoting from the article, disqualified for casting an invalid vote and then be substituted.
Now, that's so interesting because they're
valid as
yeah,
they do it, too.
Yeah, that's coherent with what I think I know, because when the presidential electors vote, then the results of their vote appear on something that I think is called a certificate of ascertainment, which mm-hmm. is given the state seal, literally, and the Secretary of State of a state is the person who does that, and that is the document that will be sent to Congress to be opened at the joint session in early January where the votes are actually counted. You may recall that in 2001, the President of the United States Senate, who was Vice President Al Gore, had the dubious distinction of having to announce his own defeat, which is yeah. exactly what happened to the President of the Senate in 1961, Vice President Richard Nixon.
Dubious Whoa. Distinction.
Well, you know, I'm sure they were, maybe they were over their herd of having narrowly lost and were sort of sheepish or even laughing about it.
Max, anything else that you had on your mind, man?
Well, I think the question is, do you want a camera in the Colorado State Capitol watching the Secretary of State ordering a state trooper to arrest yes. the electors yes. as they cast a faithless vote and
then filling in the
next person until they get the vote that the law requires?
Now, has there been any talk out in Denver that some of the Democratic electors are going to cast protest votes or something?
Yeah, but
instead of for Hillary Clinton, for whom they were pledged when they ran?
They actually sued the state for the right to cast a faithless or a vote contrary to the law. And the judge has officially warned them that they will face arrest and fines.
Yeah, but see, here's the thing. That this goes back to my original question of the night. Why all of this nonsense bullshit? I mean, why does it have to be a physical person? If we're just talking about a way, if we're talking about a way to negate us from devolving into mob rule, I understand the need for the Electoral College. I am still a big believer in it. What I don't understand is the actual need to have physical, living, breathing people to be representing each electoral vote that actually have some kind of a say in whether or not they go out there and they fulfill what the popular vote has mandated.
Now, Frank, you're not having enough fun with this. You are a constitutionalist. The answer to your question is to be found in the Constitution of the United States, which lays out how presidents are selected. They're selected by electors, and it gives to the states the power to choose those electors. So from day one, 1787, the electors have always been people. They've never been anything other than people. It's sort of like some of these people now purport to be surprised about the Electoral College. I guess they weren't following the election campaign in the news. How many times were we told 270 to win? You know, everybody knows that.
I've got the Constitution right here. You want me to read Article 2?
If you wish. Not the whole thing.
No.
Just about the electors.
Okay, let me see here. The electors shall meet in their respective states and vote by ballot for two persons, of whom one at least shall not be an inhabitant of the same state with themselves. And they shall make a list of all the persons voted for and of the number of votes for each, which list they shall sign and certify and transmit sealed to the seat of the government of the United States, directed to the President of the Senate. The President of the Senate shall, in the presence of the Senate and House of Representatives, open all the certificates. The votes shall be counted. The person having the greatest number of votes shall be the President.
Well, there you go. And the Secretary of State in Colorado has read that and has said, if some faithless elector votes wrong, I'm not certifying it.
Well, there you go.
Right. And I would say, so the elector process in here, like you said, it's somebody pays $5,000 or not pays, donates $5,000 right. to the party and they get an elector position. But they also have to, under state law, sign an affidavit under penalty of perjury to follow the law and vote with the popular vote of the state. So there's a perjury case against them.
Well, that's interesting. And, mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess people put in safeguards to try to be sure that people are not going to be faithless. But, again, if you were the head of the Democratic Party in Pueblo for 35 years. It'd be a nice honor to get at your retirement. You can be an elector, and then you can get a souvenir, and you can hand it down to your children or something. And those are the kind of people who get chosen to be electors. Now, of course, in every barrel, there's one rotten apple. So, what did Frank say? 4 faithless electors in the history of the United States. That's not too many.
Yeah, I don't know if we're going to get 38 here.
I don't think so. But, actually, when we had the strange election of 2000, if you'll recall, 270 to win, and George W. Bush got 271, that time there was really a little more speculation than if just a couple of people, that's all it would have taken.
No, if this was closer, I'd be making buttons.
And, of course, if you really want to be an anarchist and have fun, if just a couple of people had done that in 2000, then it would have been 269 to 269.
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, if the Electoral College does not produce a majority, then the House of Representatives gets to have the fun.
Yeah, and at that point, in 2000, the House was controlled by Republicans?
That I can't recall. I think so.
So then that would have been a fail-safe right there, too. At that point, whoever controls the House, that's the fail-safe. So it's key to go into an election already controlling Congress if you're looking at this from a partisan standpoint.
Yeah, and Frank, if you don't want to have these people, then you're going to have to propose a constitutional amendment because, as you just read, they're people. And it's interesting that it states, I have not looked at that in a long time, that they have to vote by ballot because, like I said, I've watched occasionally some of the meetings of the electors in the state capitals on C-SPAN. And, I have noticed that they are, actually writing down, who they're voting for. And then in some of the states, they put them in a ballot box in the state legislative chamber. And then somebody opens them up and counts them one by one in public.
Hey, Mac,
Now I'm curious because Hillary Clinton, she's from New York, right? So how constitutionally are the electors able to vote for her? Or is it just that because Tim Kaine... They can vote for Tim Kaine and Hillary Clinton.
Well, you can't be from the same state, both of them. Plus, there's I think it's Amendment 11 dealt with this quirk that produced, you were talking about Jefferson and Adams, Adams being president and Jefferson vice president at the same time, even though they were kind of at loggerheads. And then in 1800, Jefferson defeated Adams. But, they weren't getting along well then. Adams refused to attend the inauguration.
Mm. Yeah. Well, hey, Max, thank you so much for the call, man. This is a great call.
Thank you, guys.
All righty.
Take care, Professor.
Nice to talk to you.
So there you go. Let me look in the chat. What's going on there? Got people hanging out. We had a great show here tonight. Hey, you know what? Let's go off topic for a little bit. I started off the show with this. Now, Professor, I was talking about this before. Now, my mother, she's the type of person. She has this – she loves – she's a big, big-time Broadway fangirl. She loves Patti LuPone. She is always online at the backstage door to get autographs and pictures and all that. Her and my father have been big like this for decades now.
So they're all in the Hamilton now?
I don't know. I my mother didn't see Hamilton. I don't know if my father went out to see it.
It's still too expensive.
Have you seen it?
I have not seen it, but Frank, you may or may not recall that Hamilton is my middle name.
Yes.
So, of course, I've got a little bit of an extra interest in that.
Well, hey, let's especially if it goes down. I still haven't seen Book of Mormon because all these tickets are so
expensive.
Well,
yeah, these things aren't cheap anymore, are they?
No, absolutely not. But the funny thing here is that my mother, she's got this thing. Well, a lot of people do this, but whenever she sees something, she can't help but try to want to talk about it or give you a warning that something fun is coming or something.
Right.
I usually tend to need her to be out of the room when I'm watching something she's already watched before. And if we are in the room and I have watched something that she has not watched, she's the type that will keep interrupting the movie to ask what's going to happen next. And I'm just like, Mom, stop. So now, what does she do? She goes to this Patti LuPone thing. Patti LuPone and Christine Ebersole, whatever. They were talking with New York Times, and they were performing numbers from their new musical, War Paint. and they opened it up for questions. Now, my mother went to this interview not knowing that they were going to open up the floor for questions. So she goes, and she just immediately runs up to the microphone. At that point, not even knowing what the hell she's going to ask, she just went. So here's a clip, probably around – you have to listen to this. It's okay. Unbelievable. Let me see here, around the 52 minutes and 23 seconds, I think she said. Hold on. She pulls. This is unbelievable. Let's see here. 52.
And thank you very much.
Hold on a second.
Nobody wants to ask us a question. Christine, what'd you do today?
That's Patti LuPone. You're going to hear my mother's voice very soon.
All right.
Do you want to go to the mic? Yes, go to the mic.
Oh, God, here she comes.
Oh, no, good well, for you. No, talk need loud.
Okay, hold on. Wait, this is on New York Times here.
Oh, I almost forgot. We have questions from, thank you, for our, we have questions from our Facebook audience, too. Oh,
hi.
I don't know who this is.
I really look up to you so much.
Get out of here. You're not my mom. Hold on.
But feminism back then,
so she goes up there, yes. And she's starting to put together this question, and she starts putting spoilers out there about the ending of this play.
Uh-oh.
My mom, I was like, what are you doing? So she's showing this. She came into my office today, and she said, hey, you have to look at this. And I said, Mom, you did it. I said, I hope you know that it's not just me. You see, even Patti LuPone wants you to keep your mouth shut when you're talking about this, but we have to try to get this out here.
If Christine, do you want to talk to that?
Well, I mean, I'm just...
Do you know what I mean? So why should there be any...
Where is this?
Yeah. Do you know what I mean?
You know... Hold on. This might be it.
And thank you very much.
Oh, God. Professor, I don't know how to find this right now.
And you're Joe Tech.
After you,
I know, but it's such a long video, and it's...
And
where is she?
Context of feminism, how do you think... Thank you.
Where's my mother? No, that's
context
not her.
Context of feminism.
Oh.
Incredibly... Look at everything in...
All right, I'm going to have to find this some other time.
All right, next time.
Hilarious.
You can't let the cat out of the bag. Everybody stays tuned because they want to know what's going to happen.
Why did she do it? Why does she do it, I ask? Why do you want to just sit
it's
back?
It's like the
relax?
Person says, I have a secret, but I can't tell you.
It's like,
and
why?
And then they want to tell you.
Why? Why are you bringing this up? But anything else you'd like to add, Professor, before we wrap up this episode of the podcast? It was awesome having you back on.
Well, it's been a lot of fun. I appreciate it, and I hope we can do it again soon. The Pearl Harbor anniversary definitely got me to thinking because, as you'll recall, Frank, I have been teaching World War II for a long time, and naturally my parents' generation was the generation of World War II. My father was the proverbial 17-year-old on Pearl Harbor Day, so you know what happened to him. The only question is which. The answer is Army. And then my uncle, the same thing. So World War II is a compelling, compelling thing. Attack on Hawaii is something, I think, that really cemented Hawaii to the mainland. And I think it has something to do with Hawaii in the 1950s, you know, choosing the path of statehood. And then, of course, in the early 60s, little Barack Obama enters the world in Hawaii. And Hawaii is such an intriguing place. It is distinctive of the 50 states, for sure. And I've often wished that President Obama, maybe in his memoirs to do this, would sort of, you know, talk more about Hawaii, because I can only imagine what it was like to grow up in a place like that, and especially in his childhood, you know, much, much closer to the attack and the shock of being in a place that was attacked. And, of course, as the ceremonials reminded everybody, there's a whole lot of people who lost their lives in that attack.
And it's also so remote. Everything. And it's also so remote, too. And, you know, on Pearl Harbor Day, we were talking about it a little bit. Of course, we spoke about Pearl Harbor on the 8th because I wanted to open up the show with FDR's address to Congress.
Right.
And Admiral Yamamoto was the first one was the one to ask where the aircraft carrier were. Yeah, where the aircraft carriers were, because of course they were not there in Pearl Harbor. And of course the information being delivered to him that they were not at Pearl Harbor was what by legend says prompted the whole "I fear that we just awoken a sleeping giant." Right. Where were the aircraft carriers that day? I know that they were kind of all split up and doing different things and delivering.
Well, they don't always just sit and dock, and I suppose you could we were talking about Germany. The Iron Chancellor Bismarck is supposed to have said, "God looks after lost children, puppy dogs in the United States of America." So it was certainly providential in the extreme that those carriers were not there, since the Japanese strategic vision was to just kind of in one lightning-type blitzkrieg blow destroy U.S. military power in the Pacific. And even if the U.S. decided to try to get up and, you know, fight back, it would take too long. It didn't take nearly as long as they thought, and that's one of the big reasons why things turned out.
And then, of course, by 1944, we had produced over 100 aircraft carriers to Japan's 25, and I think that we were producing about 100,000 aircraft a year by 1944. So, I mean, the full might of American industrial strength was completely unleashed by that point.
Yeah, it is an example of how it's good to try to broaden your knowledge and have international understanding, because I do think one of the biggest problems Japan had is their leadership had a limited understanding of the United States. I think that's true of Hitler, too. Therefore, they just didn't seem to believe the United States would either be able to do what it did or would bother to. I was recently talking about the build-up to the American Civil War, and then the number one question in 1861 when secession comes is, will the North fight? And especially, will they sustain it? Because the North doesn't have to. The North's not fearing, really, that the South wants to conquer it. The South just wants to be left alone. Japan would say, you know, America's accepted the colonial empires of the Europeans being the managers of East Asia, so what do they care if the management has changed to us? But, of course, the United States did care.
Hey, you know, one more point on Japan and World War II before we get off. I was watching, what was his name? Oliver Stone put out a series on Netflix called "The Untold Story of the United States," the Untold History of the United States. That and it starts from World War II, and one of the things he highlights toward the end of the first episode, or at least toward the middle of the first episode, is Japan's blunder, much as Hitler's biggest blunder was to break the non-aggressions pact with Russia and open up that other front, but Japan choosing to go after the U.S. instead of attacking Russia itself from the East, Russia would have been completely decimated if it had Japan coming from the East and Germany from the West. So, and he attributed a lot of that to the fact that Adolf Hitler, you're talking about the odd man out of the Allies being the Soviet Union, Adolf Hitler looking at the Japanese as inferior on race levels, on culture levels, and all that, that to the point where he didn't really invest a lot of time communicating and strategizing with them, or letting them that deep into the tent, if you will. Have you ever come across any kind of that, any kind of notions of that being true in all of your studies, that there was communications lapses even between Japan and Germany, and missed chances there too with trying?
Well, there were a lot of communication gaps between Japan and Germany. That's definitely the case. With regard to whether or not Japan might have done better to have attacked Russia, well, they did. There was fighting between Russia and Japan in the very late 30s, and Russia very much got the better of Japan. And so Japan, you know, noticed that, kind of backed off, and then they made their non-aggression pact. But the other thing about it, besides that, although I think that is critical, is Japan doesn't really want to rule extreme Pacific shoreline, quote-unquote, Russia, if that's even the right name for it. What they were looking for was, more than anything else, the oil supplies, especially what we now call Indonesia, and the sort of world in the Pacific that I think, you know, modern-day China seems to be more interested in. And, of course, everybody's interested in it for trade purposes. After all, Christopher Columbus sailed west in 1492, searching for a route to the mysterious east.
Yeah, there you go. Well, you know, as we all know, you can always go far enough in one direction, you end up in the other place. So there you go.
But the world is round.
That's it. And, Professor, thank you so much for being with us on tonight. And we'll get you back on pretty soon.
Well, thanks for having me, and Merry Christmas, everybody.
And Merry Christmas to everybody. And that's it for tonight. Guys, we'll see you on tomorrow night. Here's the deal for tomorrow night, for Thursday. We're going to do a regular show. We have a couple things we have to do. Number one, I will have this clip of my mother blowing the spot of Patti LuPone on the New York Times ready. Number two, we got Ray Lewis, who actually had a meeting with Donald Trump. We got to talk about that. But then we have a lot of movie stuff. We got Rogue One. We got Star Wars stuff to talk about tomorrow because, of course, tomorrow night at 10:30 p.m., we're going to see the early premiere over here in New York, so there's going to be that. So we'll have a lot of fun tomorrow night. We won't get too deep. I'm glad we got to do some fun history tonight because I'll tell you, the politics stuff is boring and depressing. So this is a lot more fun, you know.
History's always fun.
Of course it is. All right, everybody, so have a great one and be well.